across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
And as the show's called Sunday Brunch, my next guest, Dr. Simon Paul. Good morning, Simon.
Morning, Ian.
Nice to see you again.
And you too.
It's been a while, actually, isn't it, since we last bumped into one another? I think it was... You've been on a few times, but you came on when I just started my Saturday morning, my slightly later show from 10 till midday, and I've been doing that programme for nearly 3 and a bit years, so it must be about 3 years since I've seen you.
I think so.
And you haven't aged at all.
Ah, you're very kind.
So, you, Simon, you're a Cambridge GP, and you have a particular interest in diet, specifically the Mediterranean diet, and you're always very kind and very generous. You always bring me something to eat when you come in.
Yeah, well, I figure it's about time for elevenses, isn't it? And I'm sure that's the only reason why you invite me in, which I bring you a snack. But I brought you in some olives and some nuts today so that you don't need to resort to the cocoa popo sugar puffs. You can have something healthy.
Well, why don't we work through these things? So if I've got the olives, you've even given me a little stick to grab them with. And why would having some olives be good for me? What are the benefits of olives as I tuck into my olives here?
Yeah, so olives are a great snack as part of the Mediterranean diet, and they contain good fats and compounds we call polyphenols, which are antioxidants, natural antioxidants in the olives. So they're really good for you and very much part of the Mediterranean diet.
And is there, obviously, now these ones have got stones in, I noticed, but any health benefit to having the stones in your olives as opposed to removed?
No, I don't think so. I think basically you eat the flesh of the olive, and that's where you get the goodness in the fats and the antioxidants. And so the stones are there just to really give you something hopefully you won't crunch on.
Mm, they're very nice, actually, aren't they? If you do hit a stone with your teeth, you know about it, don't you?
You do.
I've done that a few times. Quite painful.
Yeah.
And we've got the nuts here. Now, tell me, nuts... I've heard it said, and you tell me whether this is right or not, that we should all eat a handful of nuts every day. They are very good for us, aren't they, I believe?
That's exactly right. Again, they contain lots of good fats and lots of minerals as well, and some vitamin E. So antioxidants, again, anti-inflammatory compounds in nuts, very good for you and very much central to the Mediterranean diet. Generally, we recommend non-salted nuts, so almonds and hazelnuts and walnuts and so on. And interestingly, there was an article only this week, actually, published in the journal Nutrition, talking about the role that nuts can play in helping, shall we say, male fertility issues. I know this is a family show, isn't it? So we can't go into that in great detail, but people reported having... that was actually 60 grams of nuts a day, which is a couple of handfuls of nuts a day, improved their... everyday experience of relationships.
You put that very nicely, Simon. If my wife's listening at home, by the way, she's currently clearing out the cupboard and getting rid of all the nuts, I think. They're very nice, actually. What type are they that you brought in?
They're almonds.
Mm, they're lovely, aren't they? I do like nuts, actually. Not very delicious. And the final thing that you brought in, now I'm going to have to do this very carefully so as not to make a mess, but you brought in some olive oil in the bottle. Now, I know that you're... Do you still import olive oil? Do you still have the business importing it?
No, I no longer import it. I just really speak about the health benefits of olive oil as part of the Mediterranean diet now. So yes, we don't bring it in anymore, but I'm always up for recommending some good olive oils to people.
Yeah, well, in fact, I was watching you on YouTube, I think from about a year ago, at an olive oil awards event. I think it was in London. And you were, I think you were tasting, you had a whole, it was like a wine tasting, but instead of tasting wine, you were tasting olive oil. Is that something that you do quite a lot of?
Yes, that's right. So I introduce people to the different tastes of olive oil. You can smell fruitiness and you can taste taste bitterness and pepperiness, pungency and so on. And actually in the olive oil that I brought in today, that's very strong olive oil with plenty of anti-inflammatory and antioxidant compounds in it. It's harvested very early in the season to maximise those health-benefiting compounds. So it'll be quite pungent, quite strong and quite bitter, and may even make you cough a little bit.
Okay.
But that's very good and that's very healthy for you. So go carefully on that particular oil if you're just taking it without any food.
Okay.
But it's a very, very healthy oil, so that'll set you up with your nuts for the day.
Right, okay. Well, I've got some on my spoon here, so I've got a bit of a cough anyway because I had a cold. And you know at the end of a cold you sometimes get a bit of a cough, so hopefully this won't set me off too much. But that's very nice, actually. It's very... you wouldn't normally think to yourself, would you? Olive oil is lovely on salads and things, but to actually just pop it on a spoon and to taste it, I guess it's because it's a good quality one. Would you say that lower quality oils would not be so pleasant to eat in the way that I've just done, or is that not necessarily the case?
No, that's absolutely the case, yeah. So always go for extra virgin olive oil and taste different oils and see which you like, because there is a very, very, there's very variable qualities of olive oil, and usually ones that are produced by small producers or from regions rather than the big bottlers. Usually those smaller olive oils with a bit of provenance, and you can see the pride of the grower and the producer on the bottle perhaps expressed, and they taste fantastic on their own or with salads or with cooking and so on. And the story about the cough on olive oil is very interesting as well, because there was a sensory scientist in the States who was asked to investigate a cough mixture that was rather paradoxically causing people to cough.
Right.
And he identified that it was the ibuprofen in the cough syrup that they'd combined that was making people cough. And then he went to Italy and tasted some olive oil and got the very same cough sensation with olive oil, and identified a compound called oleocanthal, which is one of the polyphenol antioxidant and anti-inflammatory compounds. And it's very interesting because it has a similar anti-inflammatory effect as ibuprofen. And so that's possibly one of the ways in which olive oil benefits our health. So if you're going to try and find an olive oil, go for one that's peppery, that gives you a little bit of pungency, and maybe even that gives you a little bit of a cough when you taste it.
Oh, that's interesting to hear. Now, tell me something, because the kind of the diet and the work that you do with olive oil and the recommendations you make, I suppose that sort of borders the whole area of complementary medicine. But would you say that although you would recommend olive oil, you're not you're not a complementary, a physician who entirely recommends alternative therapies, or are you? Is that an area that you believe in or not?
Well, I thought the complementary medicine is complementary medicine is very broad, and I think people should access treatments that they feel help and work for themselves, but being fairly cautious about what they're getting into to make sure that they kind of trust whatever's been offered. But actually, nutrition, I think, should very much be part of mainstream medicine. And in fact, it's really, I think, a great pity that doctors often are not trained in nutrition and don't practice nutritional medicine, don't advise people about diet and lifestyle, because we know that 70 to 80% of chronic diseases can actually be prevented through lifestyle. And yet we practice, I think, a very medical model. In other words, we just give people medications or prescriptions. And so I really got interested in diet and nutrition, not as a complementary medicine, not based on complementary medicine, but just actually because it should be mainstream. And rather than trying to fix people when things have gone wrong, it's actually much better to, if we get a hint of people having problems or issues with their health or with the blood pressure or with the cholesterol, just to advise about how dietary changes can really help them.
And yeah, it was prevention.
Advising, yes, exactly. And yeah. I was advising my patients to make these kind of changes and see them improve and feel better, that made me really convinced about the benefits of advising people on diet and lifestyle. And the Mediterranean diet is probably the gold standard, no matter what you see in terms of fad diets, whatever the latest fashion might be. The Mediterranean diet has got millennia behind it of being a beneficial diet, and it's got an enormous amount of science as well.
Do you think, because we're seeing, aren't we, a lot of veganism has suddenly become extremely popular. We know that the supermarkets, who only do things for good commercial reasons, are suddenly stocking an array of, you know, vegan food. And I think this is not because people have suddenly become completely vegan. It's just because they think, well, I'll have a day a week when I eat vegan food and that'll be good for me. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think that's all a bit radical and unnecessary, or do you think that's a good thing?
Well, I think people can absolutely make choices about veganism and vegetarianism. And there are some pretty compelling arguments that we should be reducing our meat consumption, in particular our red meat consumption, not only for health, but also actually for the environment, because we know that it contributes to quite a significant amount of greenhouse gases, the raising of meat. So I think people need probably, in general, we need to be reducing our consumption, particularly of red meat. Vegan diets tend to need some supplements of some vitamins to ensure that people actually remain healthy. But again, it's a choice that people can make, and sometimes it's for ethical reasons around animal agricultural husbandry, and sometimes about environmental reasons. The Mediterranean diet is actually very marginally above the vegan diet and the vegetarian diet in terms of greenhouse emissions. Really, it's an incredibly environmentally friendly diet, and it gives people the option to have a little bit of meat now and again and to enjoy that. So I think there's a risk sometimes that people become quite tribal in terms of their diet. And so I always joke to people that I am absolutely committed ovo, lacto, pesco, pano, carno, vego, flexitarian, and I'm sticking to it, which means that I'm an omnivore, but I tend to follow the Mediterranean diet, which is meat in limited,
in moderation,
and much more moderated actually than we have in the Western world in terms of red meat. I only consume red meat approximately once a fortnight or something like that, which is, and in relatively small amounts.
We'll talk more about the Mediterranean diet, and also we'll talk about some of the work you're doing around general practice in a few minutes' time. But before we finish this section of our chat, I know you've been doing some work at something else still in the area of diet, the sugar tax. You've been involved in, or you've got some views on that, haven't you?
Well, yes. I mean, the sugar tax, I think, has been a really important step to introduce some nudges towards helping people to make healthy choices. And it's a real pity that we don't really, in our political system, actually make vegetables much more attractive by giving growers greater tax breaks and so on, in order to make vegetables more accessible and cheaper for consumers. Actually, my work with the British Medical Association has brought me in contact with the Obesity Health Alliance, and together we lobbied in Parliament with the British Medical Association to support the sugar tax, which is just a small step to just bring the politics into line with what we should be generally doing in terms of the direction of travel towards sustaining a much more healthy diet, which will actually ensure that not only are we fitter and healthier, but moving forwards, we can actually afford our healthcare, which is unfortunately a sort of perfect storm waiting to happen in terms of the costs around increasing levels of obesity and diabetes and chronic disease. So anything we can do to just make that small difference to actually make people's lives more healthier, I think, are very much worthwhile pursuing. Not so much as a nanny state, but I think the politics needs to be there at the right place at the right time.
Fascinating stuff, and I absolutely spot on in terms of the demand that's being placed on general practice. You know, where you are, you must have seen that change so dramatically in your career. And radical action, I think, is needed to help change things, if we can change things. Let's talk a bit, let's pick that up and talk about it a little bit more in a few minutes' time. But I'm going to play you a song by Meghan Trainor, and then we'll talk more with Dr. Simon Paul. Image 105 Radio on a Sunday morning. It's Sunday brunch with Ian Dayborn in the chair for this week, joined by Cambridge GP Dr. Simon Paul, a man with an interest in diet. We've been talking about the Mediterranean diet, which Simon is passionate about, and promoting it for, you know, good health and all of that. And Simon, you also, we started to sort of chat a little bit about the fact that general practice, getting an appointment, I'm sure we've all had that experience of trying to get an appointment with your doctor, and it's getting really hard, and it's a real problem, isn't it? And it's partly because I think the way general practice sometimes works and operates. What's happening in here in Cambridge around trying to change things and maybe redesign the way general practice works?
Well, it's clearly been the case that demand has increased dramatically over the last sort of 10 to 15 years in particular. So we have many more people with long-term illnesses and diseases. We have a rising elderly population. And so GPs have been struggling, essentially, I think, with the demand over the last sort of 10, 15 years in particular. And that's meant that there have been a number of changes that have had to be made. And so we do actually now have some access to GPs at the weekend and in the evening at centres across Cambridge, the extended access services. Often your GP will be running extended hours, which is within their own practice, but just perhaps on a Saturday or late into the evening, to try to soak up that demand. But the trouble is that it's actually quite difficult at the moment to recruit GPs, because knowing that the demand is so great and that the job is so busy and that the days are increasingly 12-hour days, people are somewhat put off coming into general practice. And so we, in effect, have that perfect storm of increasing demand and therefore it becoming a more challenging job, and therefore people becoming less keen to, in particular, become partners in practices. So that's, I think, why we've got to the position where we are in relation to how difficult it is sometimes to see us.
And do you think part of the problem, we're probably not going to solve it all in a 10-minute radio interview, but do you think part of the problem is the public themselves being so demanding? We all go online now, don't we? We all have a look at Google the minute we get a headache and convince ourselves that we've got something, I'm as guilty as everyone, got something terrible wrong with us. And then we ring the surgery and we insist on seeing a GP, when in fact maybe some other professional could see us and deal with us. It doesn't have to be the GP. Is part of the solution about getting a wider mix of professionals in to see patients, not just seeing your doctor?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's too easy, really, to blame patients, and I wouldn't want to do that, actually, because I think patients, by and large, are actually really responsible about the way they handle their healthcare. There are lots of things that people can do, of course, for self-care and see a pharmacist or try to see if their symptoms can be managed at home if they're fairly mild symptoms. But I think it really is just an increase in the demand and the complexity of medicine, and the fact that actually we can do much more for patients now than we used to do 20 years ago. The number of advances that have been made in managing people with illnesses and conditions has increased. But I think you are right that one answer, if we haven't got enough GPs, and certainly we are at least 5,000 GPs short in the country, one option is to get people to be able to see other health professionals. And of course, at the moment, the system is not really set up so that people can access those health professionals directly. So whilst, again, one might say they should be seeing another health professional, actually, we've got to make sure that they can do, and that actually we signpost people to see the right person at the right place at the right time. And one of the reasoning behind that is that it's felt that if GPs were to work more collaboratively in what are called primary care networks in larger groups, either with practices merging or just practices working more collaboratively together, then we can employ other members of staff who are not GPs, but who have skills that we can offer to patients with particular problems. So, say, musculoskeletal problems, problems with joints, bones, things that people may need to see a physio for, or maybe a pharmacist about their medication for some advice, or maybe even just to see a nurse to see for a diagnosis of a minor illness or look after their long-term condition. So at the moment, we're on a project which is getting practices together to work more closely to try and provide a greater breadth of services.
So presumably, in practical terms, the way that might work is that if you do want a physiotherapist, you've got a lot of patients who probably could benefit from seeing a physiotherapist, but you can't maybe justify employing a physiotherapist at every single practice in an area. You would work together with other practices. You would have a physio that you could all refer patients to, and that's how you would work. So the patient may not see the physiotherapist at their own GP's practice, but you might say, but if you go up the road to Cherry Hinton or wherever, we'll arrange for you to see a physio. Is that the kind of way it might work?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's the economies of scale of allowing us to employ health professionals to do that kind of thing. You're exactly right. So, and that even stretches the possibility of having paramedics perhaps visiting elderly people in their home who've become acutely unwell and who maybe can be looked after and managed at home, and that's probably where they would like to be managed,
yes,
rather than to go into hospital and thereby increase the costs to the health service, but also to actually the people don't want to be in hospital if they can be managed at home, quite rightly. And so it's about employing members of staff who can support what we do in general practice.
And presumably at the moment, everything you say makes complete sense. It sounds like it almost sounds like, gosh, why didn't we think of this before kind of plan? But we're starting to trial this now to see how it goes. Are we still at the stage where we don't know whether it's working or not, or can we start to see yet this new model, this new network where you go to the right person? Can we see any evidence yet that it's actually starting to change things with the demand?
So primary care networks just started this April, so
right,
it is early days. And in the first year, we're anticipating that most practices will have in place, working for the group, working collaboratively, a pharmacist, maybe spending a day or two at any one surgery per week, but spread across that group of surgeries. So a pharmacist who can answer medication queries and questions and who can make sure that people's medication is all up to date, perhaps if they've been discharged from hospital, and also what's called a social prescriber. And a social prescriber is a person who knows the ins and outs of how to access social services, how to access other support in the community. And it's felt that many people who come and see their GP might benefit from actually having access to those kind of services. But then over the next 2 to 3 to 4 years, there are ambitions to invest in nursing staff, physiotherapists, as we've talked about, perhaps visiting paramedics, and a whole range of staff. So we may begin to see those improvements over the next sort of 2, 3, 4 years, we're hoping.
Excellent. Well, Simon, I could chat with you all the way through until 1 o'clock about this. We're nearly pretty much out of time. And social prescribing that you were just starting to speak about there, I know that's another whole area we could talk about, which I think is particularly for older people who are maybe lonely. It's a way of maybe helping them, not necessarily by giving them prescribed drugs and things, but as you say, signposting them to places where they can meet other people and mix with people and start to sort of hopefully feel happier in themselves. Thank you for coming in and chatting to me. Thank you for your nuts, but that sounds a bit inappropriate, doesn't it? Thank you for the olive oil and the olives and the things that you brought in, Dr. Simon Paul. Lovely to have you in as a guest as ever.
Thank you, Ian.